Today's sponsor is Shudder, the premium streaming video service devoted to horror, thrillers, and suspense. Backed by AMC Networks, Shudder has a growing and dynamic selection of thrilling premieres, originals, and exclusives, including Rob Zombie's 31, the Ring vs. The Grudge franchise mashup, Sadako vs. Kayoko, and is the only place to see the highly influential Ghostwatch.
Exclusively on Shudder is Among the Living, from the directors of the French classic Inside, and never released in the United States until now. Among the Living. When three boys skip school to wander an abandoned film studio, they stumble upon a woman in chains being dragged by a man in a clown mask. Before they can escape, they see something that's been hidden for years, which they were not meant to see. Among the Living is now streaming only on Shudder.
Ooh, Shudder is available on the web, iOS, Android, Chromecast, Apple TV, Roku, and starting this month, Xbox One and Amazon Fire TV and Fire TV Stick for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But Shockwave's listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. That is one free month. Just enter SHOCK at checkout.
Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of horror available to stream anywhere. And just enter SHOCK at checkout and get your free month.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 56 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. Sitting with me is Mr. Elric Kane.
Whoa, man, summer's over, huh?
No, we're in the middle of it.
I mean, our summer, our little paradise away.
Oh,
you know, that was such paradise? A downer. Yeah. Oh my God.
Us being apart was paradise to you?
I missed you, Jerry.
Wow. I missed you guys too.
Wow. Really? You don't
All right, let me
lie
get to
me.
Somebody with
I missed your loud shirts, Kane.
Yeah, let me get to the co-hosts that have emotions. Ryan Turek.
I missed you, Rob, and you, Elric, and even you, Becca.
Even
That's
me.
Right.
And even Ernie.
Ernie, our sound engineer. Props to him. He's here as well as Rebecca McKendry.
What up? I missed you guys.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You guys are liars. I'm not even telling the truth.
We're only gone for 2 weeks.
That's like talk radio.
3 weeks?
It's been a while. Anybody that's marathoning the show in the future, I'm sorry that we're spending this much time talking about the break that we took because it won't matter if you're marathoning.
It won't matter.
That's true.
You had a couple bonus episodes.
But we are back. We've got some great stuff lined up.
Yeah. We got a busy summer ahead.
I'm
busy
excited summer. About the next month because we are doing a theme month next month. Have we announced the theme yet, guys?
No. This is secret. August.
August will be a special themed month.
Themed month, which we are kicking off at Midsummer Scream Con.
Yes.
When is that? When are we? I need to know because apparently we're guests.
It is
the 29th and the 30th in Long Beach, and we will be doing a live show on July 29th in the afternoon.
1 p.m.
1 p.m. Thank you.
And it is known that we are doing
Sharksploitation.
That's right. Summertime baby.
Tip of the hat to our month theme.
I held the guys down and I beat them liberally until they let me do Sharksploitation. So.
Wow.
And that's why I'm not going.
Yeah, unfortunately,
The group consensus. We all love our shark films.
Elric can't make it. We're working on a special guest, though, to replace him, even though he's irreplaceable.
I mean, like, since everybody knows it's Sharksploitation, we might as well just divulge what the theme is for August. We're going to delve into exploitation films week after week with special guest each week.
Whoa, holy shit. This was unplanned.
What an actor, let me tell you.
August exploitation should be a lot of fun.
Excited. August exploitation.
Yeah, and the guests we have come lined up are going to be amazing.
I mean, one is probably, if it comes through, is going to be one of the most legendary guests we've ever had. And I mean, I'm saying that, like, this is probably going to be one of the best guests we've ever had on either show.
Yeah.
So there's that.
I think you're right, Rob.
That you are. Elric, get that game face on. It's great. Ryan came up with this idea, and it's one of the things we're going to flirt with in terms of the
mixing
format of the show and mixing things up. You do X amount of episodes. It's time to mix it up. And I really love this. Ryan was like, let's take months at a time and curate them the way we would a magazine.
So when we do
topics, guests, and how we would put it together if it was a mag.
Exactly. And occasionally, you know, you'll come upon a month which is just full of diversity. We don't have one specific theme per month.
Like,
but
there's so much going on in October. I don't know if we can
But we might have a guest that might inform a specific theme that we'd get really excited about. be able to lend you guys some new titles to look into.
So. Yeah, more topics and everything. I think it totally makes sense. Evolution, baby.
Evolution, baby. So when we do our Nunsploitation night, what's everybody bringing to the table? I'll hold you guys down.
Well, that will have to be an episode one.
That's going
to
be a rough one.
I'll work on that one, guys. I'll keep pushing.
And so obviously you'll see us at Midnight Summer Scream. Midsummer Scream at the end of July. But Ryan, you just announced this very cool event that's going to happen here in Los Angeles,
September and October.
Tell us the name and tell us what it is and how the hell this came together.
Slashback video, guys.
Love it.
Slashback video. So it came about because I was sitting down with Gustavo Cooper, a really good friend of mine, and he had just seen in the press that they did that Everything is Terrible, Jerry Maguire video store thing.
Right.
And he was like, you got to do something for horror, man. It's got to be something in that vein. And I was like, yeah. And then it started spiraling. Like I couldn't sleep that night. And I was like spitballing ideas and thinking about things. And I teamed up with Bearded Ladies Mystic Museum on Magnolia Boulevard in Burbank. And what we're doing is the Mystic Museum has some really great gallery space, really large gallery space. So what we're going to do is we're going to recreate a mom and pop video store from the 1980s and give a generation of horror fans a sensory experience that they do not get by fucking flipping through Netflix and iTunes and Amazon and all these other kind of things and have them walk through an experience in which they can actually physically see VHS tapes and gaze upon. I mean, we've got a lot of people donating VHS tapes, a lot of rare stuff.
Yeah.
Like stuff that you could probably fetch for quite a, you know, good sum. And it's going to be part sensory, kind of immersive experience and part art show. So when you walk in, there's going to be like a doorway and it's going to be curtained and it's going to say Slashback Video above the, you know, in a big light box sign. And when you walk in, your ticket is going to be a clamshell box. And what you have to do to get admittance is put it in the drop box at the check-in counter.
That's cool.
And then you can go and walk around. We're going to have an I don't want to give away the entire thing, but we're going to have a lot of cool stuff, a lot of great posters on display.
Are they pre-tattered? And sun bleached and pre-tattered.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on what we can find. I mean, we've got a good collection of standees and tabletop promos and posters and VHS tapes.
You may borrow my another 48 hours clock if you like, which I took
with. Oh, that you should.
It's hanging in my kitchen.
And when the video store in my hometown was closing down and selling off all their stock, as I was like walking out, I had like a car full of videotapes and I looked up and that clock had been hanging above that clerk since like the movie came out. And I literally said, how much for the another 48 hours clock? And he looks up and he goes, $5. And I was like, done. Yeah. And it's been hanging in my kitchen.
That is actually great. It doesn't tie thematically into the entire store because the entire store is mostly going to be all horror, but I still want to borrow
it. I also have a Space Camp pennant I bought off that same video store.
Nice.
Oh my God.
Will there be a private section out the corner?
No.
The adult corner, you mean?
No adult corner.
We won't be gung rob.
But it's going to be, like I said, part immersive, part educational, part art show because we've invited a bunch of artists to come to the table. And basically, we gave them a clamshell and said, do your thing. Do whatever you want.
Oh, wow.
So
that's
a bunch
really
of artists are going to, I know like one artist, Gary Pullen, gave me a sneak preview of what he's doing. It's fucking cool.
It's one of everybody's favorite
remakes.
Wow.
And basically they're just going to take a clamshell and just work their magic, whether it's creating something new or recreating something, you know. So yeah, it's just going to be a fun experience and we're going to kind of be partnered with the Ben Cooper art show that's also occurring at the same time. Ben Cooper being the mask.
Hey, you know,
it's
going to
be a big mask
show.
I'm
doing the Ben Cooper panel at Midsummer Scream, and we have come full circle.
Well, Ben Cooper's making a big comeback, so they are going to be one part of our show, and then it'll Slashback Video will be kind of a fixture to the in the next room over. So it's going to be a lot of fun,
really cool.
And we're going to have a checkout counter. We're going to have a big backdrop so people can take photos. I mean, we're just going to try to recreate.
Will there be a TV playing?
Of course.
Needs to have Time Bandits playing on loop.
Yeah. You just can't take the video.
It's true.
You can't take them out.
Let's make that clear.
I'm putting some of mine in there, too.
Yes, you are.
You can't go home with my scanner sequel.
That's you want to borrow my black room? It's very rare.
Anything, my VHS, I was telling Ryan earlier when he was asking if I still had like the VHS tapes, I parsed down my collection and the only things I kept now were the things that you can only get on VHS. So like my Necronomicon Book of the Dead I still have.
Yeah.
But if I had a DVD copy, I went ahead and let go of the VHS because I've tried to watch VHS recently and it's just a little bit it's more tough. Painful. I will watch VHS because I'm about to talk about a VHS movie I watched this week.
Segue.
So anyways, it's gonna be a lot of fun. And again, it's like you can't rent, you can't buy, but the Slashback video artwork done by Devin Whitehead, we're going to make that sure that's available to people. But it's just going to be a fun experience in which you could just walk in, partake in like just looking at these. It's like a museum. That's really what awesome. It is. It's a museum experience.
And if it goes really well, maybe you just start a little video store there.
I have already taken in a URL.
Not a terrible idea, a little video store.
That's what I've always wanted, especially with all this Blu-ray stuff. But so this kicks off when? In September?
September 9th is the opening reception. And if you do plan on going to the opening reception, get there early because Mystic Museum's art shows on opening night like wrap around the block.
Oh, wow.
And I expect that'll probably happen with this as well. But after the opening reception, it'll be open during Mystic Museum hours. And there is an admission fee, you know, because this isn't coming cheap.
Will there be a clerk working, like actual old school video clerk?
We might do that for the reception.
I think
we might have something cool for that.
Rick, you're hired.
Yeah, I did my time.
We might have something pretty cool.
I think
for
all
that.
Of us did our time. Yeah. We all worked in video stores, right?
I would do it for a couple hours. It'd be fun just during a regular day. Just to recommend things to people.
We could be like those two dudes that just took more customers.
All right, 100%. Will, let's guarantee. Me and you are going to do it. At least a night we're going
to
do there.
I do want to give a shout out to our sponsors on it. We have Fright Rags, Creepy Company, Waxwork Records, Phantom Carriage Brewery, and Mixtape Massacre, our friends at Mixtape Massacre.
All people that we...
that is a damn fine assortment.
I know. They all came to the table and they were like, we know what you're doing. We love what you're doing. Let's do this. And if you go to the reception or you go to the show, there will be merch. They're all
great
stuff.
Great.
And I think Phantom Carriage Brewery is going to make a special Slashback video beer.
Hey, nice. I'm excited about it. We'll drink that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
So anyways, I hope to see you guys
somewhere. Maybe we could do something Shockwaves related.
I think we're talking about
there.
Trying to do a show in there. Yeah.
So we'll see.
Well, the funny thing is Mystic Museum, which is just a terrific venue in its own right, they do a ghost hunting a popular ghost hunting podcast in their back room.
Oh. Yep.
And every time I go there, they're always recording. So they must have good space.
Right.
Anyways. Cool. So yeah, Slashback video, guys.
They're going to muscle in on that space for Shockwaves. Just wait, guys.
Closer to my house.
All right. So obviously we've seen a lot of material over the course of the last 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. I've narrowed my list down to just a couple here and there because we can stretch this out. But who wants to go first? Who traveled and saw stuff? Becca, you mentioned a VHS, so why don't you kick us off there?
I will kick off with the VHS tape I watched. I revisited 1991's The Boneyard. Has anyone heard of this
I've never
movie?
Heard of this.
Are you fucking serious?
I saw you
serious?
Post about it and I have no idea what it
was. Oh my God. Yeah. It is so much more obscure than I ever dreamed. So I put this in my own brain. This falls into the same realm as like Dead Alive and Return of the Living Dead. And I guarantee that as soon as you guys see the box cover, it's got a zombie poodle on the front. You're going to remember the box cover.
Oh, I know exactly what that is.
The Boneyard.
And the font is really kind of like pink and wacky.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Did you just say that?
I didn't. I said Boneyard, Pink Poodle.
The poodle is
rather small. So this movie came out in 1991. It's definitely feels like a late 80s horror comedy. So much gore, like Reanimator levels of gore in it. Mm. Amazing effects work. The
guys are looking at the artwork right now.
Oh, okay. The characters I'll talk about in one sec, but I'll start with just the general plot is these cops start getting these weird stories about this mortician in town. And so they go into the mortician's office and they find that he's got these three corpses of dead children. Like they're three children's corpses. No one knows where they came from. They just think he's a deranged serial killer. And he's like, no, this is a curse. It's a curse of my family. I have to feed them or else they come to life and they wipe out everything. And they say, oh, dude, you're crazy. Lock him up. And they bring in this psychic to be around the bodies and be able to tell where these kids came from so that they can connect them with their parents. And what happens when they get to the morgue with the cops and the psychic is the curse was real and these three children burst back to life and start killing everybody. And Phyllis Diller is in it. She plays the morgue clerk.
She looks like the poodle.
She does. It's her poodle.
Oh, that makes sense.
So much gore in this. It's very much like Return of the Living Dead, where the zombies can convert other people. It's gruesome. The effects are beautiful. The guy who directed it, this guy named James Collins, was an effects guy. He'd run an effects house for years. He did the effects on House and a bunch of other stuff. He worked a lot with Mark Sjostrom because as soon as I posted about it, Mark Sjostrom messaged me about what a great guy he was. And this was his like directorial directorial debut. I think it was may have been one of his only films he did. okay. It felt the reason that this one, I have a feeling, and I talk about this in the article, the reason I don't think it got a lot of play when it came out was because the characters are not in any way what you would think to be marketable in any capacity. It's not young people. All of the people in this movie are like over 50, except for one bubbling cop who's like maybe in his 30s.
Even the three dead kids?
The three dead kids, well, you have to assume they're a little old. They might be small, but they're old. But the main protagonist is definitely the psychic, and she is like the anti-horror movie formula. She is older. She is very, I'll call her bulky. She looks like a female John Candy, and they actually go out of their way to portray her as more bulky.
You call John Candy bulky?
That's what I would call him. And I mean, but they go out of their way. Like they put her in these ginormous sweaters, so it feels like she's swimming in everything that she's wearing anyway. So she's sweaty. Like they actually make her look sweatier. She's mannish. She's got this short cropped hair. So it's a very weird.
You've thought a lot about why this wasn't successful.
I did.
And not sold anyone in the process.
Listen,
it's so good though because
see the bulky
like,
woman in the sweater. Can't
but
wait.
It works that had to really be well because she's. Yeah. I swear. And then the person that she works with, like the second lead, is this like elderly detective. But somehow it works. You've got this older cast of people and it's like a perspective that you never see in horror films. And somehow it really works. And she gets these visions, like, because her whole job is, like, she connects children, dead children, with, like, their parents. Like, when you dig up a body and you're like, who is this? Like, she feels the body and then connects them. And so she has all these horrifying visions. And it's got a zombie poodle at the end.
Listen, if you're on the fence, it also stars Norman Fell, who is Mr. Roper.
He was
I'm
Mr.
In
Roper.
From that alone, yeah.
Yes.
Just saying.
Yes. So there's a lot to love about this movie. And there are moments of it that feel kind of silly, like the giant zombie poodle. But, I mean, it's very much like a Dead Alive feel. Mm. And yeah, it's one that I'm really sad because it was sacred to me as a kid. So much so I still own my original VHS copy. And I would take that back. It got a very limited DVD release in 2004. You can't touch a DVD copy for like under $70 now. Rumor is that Code Red may be putting it out soon. So we'll see.
Elric.
Alas.
That was Boneyard.
We're so tight now.
You've got a relationship now. So.
He listens to the show not.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So Boneyard, 1991. Boneyard. I highly recommend you guys check it out.
Cool. Nice. Ryan, what you got?
Surprisingly great.
Before I dip into the kind of weirdo cut that I actually saw before we went on break, I want to say that I revisited Land of the Dead.
Okay.
And I have not seen it in quite a while.
That's my Dennis Hopper moment.
And nose pick. And Shout Factory just, or Scream Factory
announced
they're going to do a special edition. This movie is held up remarkably well.
I think it gets better.
I think it gets better with age,
too.
And I kind of predicted, I'm not saying I was smart ass or anything, but I kind of predicted it would when it first came out because Day of the Dead got so much shit when Day of the Dead came out. And that has aged, you know, really, really well as well. Land of the Dead, I always connected to because, well, goddamn, we were getting a Romero zombie movie like after decades.
With a budget.
Still.
With a budget, exactly.
He still had money, which is
and
great
I still
cast.
Remember reading the original Dead Reckoning script and going, oh my gosh, this thing's got scope. Now, granted, between script to screen, it got pared back a little bit. But what's on the screen now, you know, works really well. It is incredibly efficient in its storytelling because it's just about our main character goes out on runs. Our main character wants to get the hell out of Dodge.
Yep.
He can't because he's brought back in a very kind of Snake Plissken-esque way to stop John Leguizamo from annihilating the little, I forgot what they call it,
it's like the
tower.
It's like a tower,
something green.
Where all the rich people are.
And then once he can accomplish this job, he can get the hell out of there. And of course, there he comes up against many challenges. And, you know, granted, Simon Baker. Simon West is the director. Simon Baker, you know, he's a little flat. So it's everybody around him who really kind of elevates the material. Robert Joy is fantastic.
So
Azar Argento.
Yeah.
And John Leguizamo proves to be the MVP of this fucking movie.
I agree with you. And I'm usually mixed on him in movies. Like sometimes I love what he does and sometimes I don't like it at all. I think he's great.
He really sells it. There's a great line after he gets bitten and his buddy walks up to him. And he's like, you want me to take care of it? And he's like, no, I always wanted to see how the other side lived. Yeah. And he sold it so fucking well. And I was like, that's still Romero lurking in our culture today, you know, still. And, you know, granted, yes, there's Big Daddy, you know, kind of moping his way across the wasteland to get to this city and being the kind of representative for zombie rights everywhere. you know, it's a little hokey, but then you look at Bub and it's like on par with Bub, I think.
Well, let me tell you something. Because I like this movie a lot. I've always liked it. I enjoyed seeing it in theaters when it came out. And the one flaw that would have made elevated this to beyond what it is there's no reason that Big Daddy shouldn't have been Bub. If that was Bub in this movie, who is now smart enough to lead a revolution with the zombies,
would be awesome.
That would have been
we'd be talking about it as like, I can't believe freaking did you Bub?
Yeah. They brought Bub back.
Yeah, if they brought Bub back, I mean, they brought back, you know, Machete, you know, the Tom Savini's Machete character. The only thing that, you know, I mean, there's a couple of things that I think are flaws, but I kind of wish that he didn't lean into making every zombie a character. Mm. Like, I think he just kind of really embraced that a little bit too much because that's what audiences responded to in, you know,
Day of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead,
you know. And so every zombie is a fucking character. There's the butcher. There's the baseball girl. And it's like, okay, just ease back a little bit on it.
Well, then what's great in Dawn is all the anonymous just shoppers. That's what I love about that.
Yeah. The soundtrack is really good. There's a great kind of Mad Max-esque riff that plays in the beginning and during the credits at the end. Dead Reckoning. I mean, the Dead Reckoning really brings about the sense of scope. Like, you can only imagine. There's a great scene in which the Dead Reckoning is just tearing down a highway, and it's firing on all cylinders. There's guns blazing. There's fucking fireworks going out the top. And you're like, that is awesome. That is Romero stepping up his game and elevating the zombie his of the Dead series. And then it took all a turn with Diarrhea and Survival.
Has anyone seen the last one? Anyone seen his last?
What was the last one?
Well, there was Survival.
Survivor.
Which I think is unwatchable.
Was that the cell phone one?
No, that's the island one where it's the two warring families on the island.
Hatfield and McCoy.
Exactly.
That's what the last one I saw was the cell phone. It was like
the Diary.
The Diary
was the last one I watched.
I didn't like Diary. Survival's okay, but because of its budget, it's so over-reliant on CG that it's not nearly as good. Yeah. It's almost like it's a cool movie if only it didn't have zombies in it.
Yeah. Did it have the forced message? Because that's what I felt in Diary is like, he's beating us with this force. Yeah. Don't look at your cell phone message for like the whole fucking
for that
movie.
Survival definitely has this thing going and it's like, oh my gosh.
But you can't take away the joy of the first three.
Oh, no,
not at all. I think Land belongs in
absolutely.
those four.
Yeah,
and
Land
it's funny
good.
As I remember not, I mean, you know, before I was watching Land on Blu-ray when it initially came out and my friend Mike came over and he's like, what's this? And I'm like, it's Land of the Dead. He's like, I don't remember it being this good. Like watching a couple of movies, like this actually is aging much better than my initial reaction. Yeah. I've always liked it, and I think with Scream Factory putting out again, it's going to find a brand new audience.
Yeah, I'll be eager to dive in and check it out again. I think it's time for fans to just kind of own up that there are four now. There are four. It's
those
part
are the
of a,
four.
Those are the big four. You can stop saying of the Dead trilogy because there are actually four films now.
Yep.
Yeah, but saying four is harder than trilogy.
It's a quadrilogy.
Quadrilogy. That's hard.
I mean, like the Wishmaster quadrilogy.
Oh God.
Yeah. The House quadrilogy.
Moving on.
All right, what do you got, Elric?
I saw that just as a catch-up. I did see that Primal Screen show finally. Is it a show or is it a one-off?
It's like a backdoor pilot.
Okay. But I liked it a lot. I thought it was good. I mean, I literally...
On Shudder, correct?
Yeah, on Shudder. Yeah. And it's on there now. It's Rodney Asher's. And just throwing out
there. I
think
if it does well enough, they're going to kick off.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. The only thing I'd say about it, I almost don't know if they need to be like 25 minutes. They feel like at like 12, they could be perfect. It's like, it's just all visuals, recreations. But I liked it. I thought it was really cool. But the first movie I definitely want to plug, and I really enjoyed it. I'd never seen it, which is always hard with some of these hour releases. Madhouse, I thought was super fun.
Oh, the dog, the
Dude,
killer dog
it, I
movie.
Thought it, I watched with Dick. So it's okay. So first, it's already made for me because it's from the director of The Visitor, which I did not know. I would have watched this a lot quicker. Ovidio G. Asanitis, who's AKA Michael Paradis, when he made The Visitor. So it's also shot in Georgia, just like The Visitor was, but it's shot halfway through the movie. I was like, wait a minute, I lived across the road from that tree. And it was it's all shot in Savannah. So I was really excited once I figured it took half the movie for me to place it. But not only that, they filmed in one of the most haunted house. The whole film is set in one of the real, known to be one of the most haunted houses in America there, which was I can't remember what kind of house it was, but it was some sort of like maybe it was an old hospital boarding house or something. Anyway, the movie, the poster or VHS art that Arrow just has on the cover is awesome. It's like a woman in the dark. You just see her eyes and a dog growling in the darkness. And it's really a cool cover. But I think maybe I went online quickly and saw a negative comment. So I was like, oh, it's probably going to be another shitty. Because I've been burned by a couple
movie?
It's a part slasher movie.
The killer's a dog.
Part psycho, like sisters, psycho kind
like
of movie.
Twin sister thing?
Twin sister kind of with a younger.
I mean, this was a blind buy before I started traveling. So you're hyping me up and I can't wait to see it.
It's really fun. It does the same. Don't look at photos because there's some spoilers I can already spot. It takes a huge, like one of those movies where the first half's a slasher and then it goes on a total, you're like, could not see that coming in a million years. So, which makes it so fun. And so, but it's also not where The Visitor is all holy fucking shit in that over the top way. This is actually a really well shot movie. And best of all, the soundtrack you're watching and then suddenly, boo, boo. Ritz Orlani score. Oh. So you even sounds a little bit like Cannibal Holocaust.
Holy
point.
Cow.
And then so it's a really good score. It looks gorgeous. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's a good movie. And you know, I won't say much about the story except it's basically there's a woman and you realize she has a twin she hasn't seen in a long time and she starts saying why she hasn't seen her twin in like 20 years and it's because every time on her birthday this twin would get a savage dog to basically come and attack her and like treat her like shit and she'd say things like, you know, there should only be one of us on her birthday. And only that is so fucking crazy. So then the sister is like in a hospital and they reunite for a second. Then the sister's like, I'm going to get you on your birthday. And then it cuts to a credit saying 3 days until her birthday. So you know what the movie's going to be. And it's really, really kind of fun.
Wow.
Because so I got nice. Burned on a couple of those Arrow, what was the big box set with the three American
films? American Horror.
I felt like they're okay. And some people I know love them. I kind of felt all three, I was kind of like, eh.
Yeah.
And this felt like, oh yeah, this is a return to good unknown.
I can't wait to check it out.
Yeah, I have it too. I just watched the trailer and some of the dog stuff in the trailer alone.
It's ridiculous.
Like,
yeah, yeah. It's a mixture of really good and terrible at the same time, those parts, but the actual movie is a good movie. I liked it.
So I watched Livid, however you want to say it, because I recently obtained a multi-regional player, and this is a film by the directors of Inside, Alexandre Bustillo and Julian Moore. And it has not been released in America. I don't know why.
I know it's their direct follow-up.
And it's their follow-up immediately after Inside.
I got two names for you.
The Weinsteins.
Bob and Harvey.
Right. Absolute sin, quite frankly. Absolute sin that they're holding this movie hostage.
That's the kind of one that would play great at like Beyond Fest or somewhere on a big screen.
You know what?
I would love to see it on a big screen.
I don't even remember Inside that well because I've only seen it once. And the one time I saw it was so potent that I was just like, I'm going to take a little step away from that. But I got Livid, the UK Blu-ray of it, threw it on one night. And this is more of a, not even traditional, but it's more of their take on a vampire story, a very intimate vampire story. And it is stylistically excellent.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks great. And the basic gist of it, which is kind of funny, is that there's a girl who we meet the main character and she is learning to basically she's working with this company that attends to the elderly, like, you know, shows up and gives them their medication and takes care of elderly people at their homes. So sort of like a nurse, but like an on-call one that goes to their places. And initially she goes into a house that has a very old lady that's like confined to bed, hasn't moved in years or whatever, but is very wealthy and has like this extraordinary house with all this amazing stuff in it. This is where it turns into Don't Breathe, or maybe Don't Breathe got it from this. Literally.
Took it from that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Fede saw this movie and was like, that's a great idea. Yep. Basically, she tells her boyfriend about this and he's like, well, me, you, and my best friend here should break into that house and steal all this woman's stuff since she's confined to a bed. Nice. So that's what they do. And again, as I mentioned, the vampire element, you can fill in the blanks of what happens when they break into this house. But I thought it was really cool. The ending is a little ambiguous. Obviously, I'm not going to tell you about it. But stylistically, it's cool. And I'm amazed that this didn't come out here. And it felt kind of special seeing it. And you're right. If somebody doesn't release it, I hope some film festival decides, hey, let's show this movie. And I'm actually excited now that you mentioned their third one is on Shudder.
Yeah, because I haven't seen it yet.
Living. So I'm down to check that one out next.
Well, and then they're all leading up to Leatherface.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's the sad thing.
And Leatherface,
is the luck.
Leatherface got picked up, didn't it?
It's coming out in October.
DirecTV is releasing it this
fall.
Yes,
and then a VOD for October. Yeah.
Okay. Did we discuss why Livid hadn't come out here yet? Yeah. Sorry,
yes,
I jumped back. Okay.
Becca had to sneak out for a second.
I had to sneak out, so I wanted
usually
to make sure.
The answer to why is a movie not out is the Weinsteins.
Weinsteins. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there you have it.
I like the movie. It's style over substance for me.
Totally. Yeah,
I
totally
saw it at Fantastic Fest 4 years ago,
Been more than that because I saw it at Scream Fest. I think it was five. It played Scream Fest my first year in Los Angeles. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, that was my first year in LA.
And there have been attempts to remake it. From my understanding, Bob and Harvey lost the remake rights and people have been shopping
like a weird
around.
Remake,
but in the wake of Don't Breathe, what's the point?
Yeah, yeah. I agree. It felt like more of an art movie.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Yeah.
But like to remake, that seems weird.
Yeah.
Okay, well, speaking of art movie, that kind of feels a little bit like a remake, but not a lot. I saw The Untamed, which Ryan, I think you talked about it briefly on the show.
Brief is all I wanted.
Well, I'm not going to get too far into it. I will say
it'd be nice to get a female's perspective on this film.
Yeah, I will say it feels like the movie was made for Elric, but I really enjoyed it. So the whole concept of it is that there is this thing in this farmhouse, and we don't really know what's going on, and it keeps you in the dark for most of the movie, though you kind of get hints. So what we're seeing is we're in kind of a city environment in Mexico, and there's a husband and wife, and then kind of their extended network around them, family and some friends and her brother. And the kind of overwhelming theme is everybody's really sexually frustrated. They're not happy with their current state. Everybody's having affairs with other people. And even those are really frustrating. Like you literally spend the first part of the movie just watching people have unfulfilling sex.
Right. So it's like life.
Yeah. So it feels pretty lifey. And so that happens. And then this girl kind of enters the scene. And throughout this entire first part of the movie, you keep getting these flashes to this like rural farmhouse and these discussions, and you don't know what's going on, but you kind of get that people might be having sex in this farmhouse, in this rural farmhouse. And then she appears in the city, and then you kind of uncover what's in the farmhouse. And it's just...
It's too much, Becca.
That's too much. I'll stop right there.
Didn't Ryan say something about tentacle sex when you were talking about
it? Yes, I did. Okay. Yes, I
there's
did.
A lot of it.
That's all you need to know.
Yeah, right. All
Ryan
you
needs
really
a buzzer.
Need
to
know.
He wants to step in and stop one of us from going too far.
All you really know to know is that there's a lot of tentacle sex. It feels kind of possession-like at moments, but other moments,
it's probably
got
one of the best scenes in film.
Oh, shit. Dave and I, when we were watching it, we spent the whole movie going, do you think they're going to go there? Oh God, it keeps going. And so it's definitely, but the whole thing is shot in this really artistic manner. And I do have to say, even though that there is tentacle sex, 90% of the movie is about emotions and relationships and being unfulfilled. Yeah. It's very heartbreaking.
Will it pair well with We Are, what is that one? We Are the Flesh? I still haven't seen it yet.
We Are the Flesh.
That was Mexico City, right?
Feels a bit less linear and a bit less constructed than this does.
No,
but they both have similar tones.
I've got a pairing for you. This is like wine and a meal. This film and what is it? Crap. I built it up and now
who's
I'm blanking
director?
On
who's
it.
The director?
I would have paired it with and I can't remember the name either, the Scarlett Johansson movie where she plays the alien. Under the Skin. I would pair it with Under the Skin.
Thank you.
Was that the one you were thinking of?
Okay, all right.
Yeah. It's got
which is one of my favorite films of that year.
Yeah,
the plots in those are very different, even kind of the whole mechanism of sex and what's happening is different in them, both of them. But somehow they both kind of left me with the same feeling of like, it's bleak, but at least there's pleasure, or is there?
Why'd you see it? Is it about to come out?
It is. It's doing a full theatrical, not full, it's doing a small theatrical starting this Friday, Friday the 28th. It opens at the Lemonly here.
Yeah, check it out. Yeah, it's an interesting, kind of film about loneliness, which is also what Under the Skin is. That's,
yeah, it's definitely, it feels
We
like,
Are the Flesh is,
I haven't seen
in
the
terms
other,
of
that
wackiness,
one I have to see,
You know what, Elric, just do yourself a favor. Yeah. Settle in, kick the family
to
the curb.
Both of them. Show it to the family.
I will say a big difference between the two. We Are the Flesh, it opens kind of like, I don't know what the fuck is going on, and then it literally like just outdoes the shocks. Every 5 minutes, it'll do something else where you're like, oh, and it just keeps getting worse.
So
this, there's very little, and then there's one crazy shock, and then there's not as much. So
sounds like my kind of movie.
It functions.
I like movies with nothing going on, and then something happens.
Like I said, I think this one was made for Elric. So,
all right.
Yeah. I just wish something happened at the end of It Comes at Night.
I missed your guys' feedback on that one. But.
Did you guys see that A24 released the Blu-ray cover art and made called attention to everybody. It was like the two main leads are on the box art. Uh-huh. They named three of the top leads, uh-huh. and they left out Carmen Jogo.
Oh, weird. Why?
She's like one of the main characters.
Yeah, yeah.
And they left her off.
Huh.
And then you see, she called attention to it on Twitter, and she's like, "Guys, we need to talk about this. What's going on?"
That's pretty weird.
That's
fucking
wild.
Weird as shit.
It'd have to be a mistake because they're pretty delicate about that kind of stuff.
So weird. All right, I want to call attention to a 1991 film called Dreamstalker.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Boneyard.
I haven't watched it yet. I've got it. I've got Dreamstalker.
You got Dreamstalker?
The VHS one, right?
The VHS
That's
one?
That's the Bleeding Skull type title.
Yeah.
I watched about 15 minutes. No, wait. And this isn't a bad thing. I watched 15 minutes, and so much happened in the course of the first 5 minutes. Like this thing took off like a rocket train. So much happened that I had to stop, and I was like, I need to watch this with at least four or five other human beings.
In the room.
I need other people. Yeah. So that's why I only watch 15, because I'm like, I'm going to get the Bad
good.
Movie Brigade okay. and force them to watch this.
I had a friend in the room, and we were waiting for our respective girlfriends to come back from wherever they were. And I was like, let's just put on Dreamstalker. And so I tossed it on. He's like, what the fuck is this? And it's directed by Christopher Mills, and I believe that's his only film. It's a Freddy Krueger ripoff, but it is basically about a motocross racer who gets into an accident, and then he starts to haunt his girlfriend in her dreams, and then he starts to pick off her friends. But
is he still dressed like a motocross?
Oh, absolutely!
Racer?
Half his face is melted off.
Does he show up on a bike?
Oh yeah.
Okay,
Becca,
Ghost Rider.
This movie delivers on all of the things that it promises. Like, you want weirdo dream logic, you got it. You want really bad effects, you got it.
I want so much motocross action.
You want someone mourning over the loss of a motocross racer after a big race, you got it.
You got
unprotected sex. I'm sorry. Wait. It is protected sex, but the condom breaks, and then he goes, Oh well, it doesn't matter. It's okay. Moving on. And he continues to keep having
sex. Is that a plot point, or do they address it?
No, like, they never address it. No, she's having a dream. She's having a wet dream about her boyfriend. And then he's like making out with her. And then he pulls out a condom. He's like, just in case. And then he puts it on, and they continue having sex. And he goes, it broke. And then they keep having sex, and you're like, what the fuck is going on in this movie?
Becca, we've been there, right? Two times each.
Two children.
Jesus Christ. Dreamstalker. I mean, like, listen, guys, it's a total piece of shit. And it's fun to watch with friends. At the end of the day, you might be wanting the 90 minutes back. But
yeah, of course, the wonderful fiends at Severn Films put this out.
Intervision.
Yeah.
So if you like Things,
yes,
the VHS style, like,
I'm a fan.
It's not good, but it's like, I mean, I literally couldn't believe the first 5 minutes, so much happened. Like, this, the way the story progresses.
I totally forgot.
Isn't he on a plane? She's on a plane, and then he proposes to her, and then it's like 5 months later.
Oh, she. Well, they're,
he's
they
like,
do
promise
do
me
some
you'll
sort
never
of,
leave me.
Yes.
Like, this is the first 2 minutes.
The first 2 minutes, like, there was heavily, they're establishing the really hot and heavy relationship she has with Ricky. But I completely forgot. There's also a turn which she goes out to this cat house in the woods. And then all of these, there's like a youth group that's like cleaning up the woods, or there's like a camp or something.
I thought it was about motocross racing.
No, well, that's the first half. But then she's trying to get over this guy, Ricky. And then she gets into a fight with a bunch of the kids. And it's like it's a full on high school fight where they're going fight, fight, fight. And she's like tumbling and ruffling, she's like literally in a fist fight with somebody. And then amongst the youth group, they start passing to each other like a fucking, they're going to shank her.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is going on in this fucking movie?
Wow.
Anyways, it's a special piece of cinema. And
you should find a way to watch it without paying for it, is what you're saying.
Yes, I am.
Watch it at a friend's house, is what you're saying.
Sorry, Severin.
Hey, they understand, I'm sure. Are we still going? Well, I won't go into it too much because I think you've talked about it quite a bit, Rob. I finally did watch Parents again.
Oh, yeah.
I had seen the trailer and boxed a million times as a kid. And it really is a good little movie, but it doesn't really feel like a horror movie, does it? It's like, it's got horror tropes, but it really is like just like a dark little drama, comedy, coming of age movie. But it's really well made.
Yeah.
And you can feel so much like Wes Anderson and Todd Solondz vibe
totally.
To it.
Yeah.
And somebody told me that in the, I didn't watch the extras, but they told me afterwards, because I said afterwards, I was like, oh, it's like a Todd Solondz film. They said Todd Solondz, right out of college, he had just left college, he was offered to direct it. But from Bob Balaban offered him right out of college, and he said no.
Oh, wow.
And, he went off and made Welcome to the Dollhouse. I'm like, oh, that makes total sense.
Wow.
Because it has that vibe, but with, you know, it's enough horror to call it horror. Anyway, it's a neat film. Mm. But the one I wanted to talk about, I actually saw Sofia Coppola's remake of The Beguiled.
Oh,
Gosh. I love the original movie. Yeah. How was the remake?
I know one of our listeners is a big fan, Ryan, out there. You know what? I turned to my wife. She found it really boring. And we went because I thought she was going to really like it. What it is it gets a lot of the buildup in the same way, but it really doesn't deliver on the tension of the setup. And there's a seediness that I love. The big original Beguiled years ago when I saw it became instantly one of my favorite, like, Clint Eastwood movies. I was like, wow, he's letting his star persona, like, totally go. And it's a seedy movie. He's a bad guy. This movie plays whether Colin Farrell's a bad guy or not way closer to its chest. It doesn't really, it's kind of almost up to the viewer. It's a really, I'll tell you the one thing it delivers on. It is one of the best looking movies I've ever seen in terms of lighting. It is probably kind of like Barry Lyndon. It's just all natural. So it's all candle because probably like, oh, there's no electricity. So they actually stuck to that. So it's gorgeous. But honestly, it's, you know, when a movie is at the one level from start to end and never really pulsates either way, there's a sequence towards the end where it goes to a place where you're like, oh my God, this could become the most tense, like disturbing, scary thing ever. And it just chooses not. So it's not Coppola not being able to deliver. It's that she's not interested in this being a horror film. You can see that her interest is a different kind of movie. Mm-hmm. So it delivers on what she's trying to make. And it's, you know, it's an interesting movie. But for me, I was like, oh, there's just this tension that I really missed from the original. Great cast. Everyone's good in this. But man, if more than anything, I want to use this as a moment for somebody to go back and discover that original first, because it is such a unique movie. It's Don Siegel too. So it was like right before Dirty Harry, literally the same year almost as Dirty Harry, but just before it.
But it totally feels like Dirty Harry because it feels like an exploitation film. I watched the original like a year ago and it feels like an exploitation film. It feels gritty and seedy and gross and mean-spirited.
Yeah, and sexual because he's like sleeping with all the different people. But everyone's good in this one. So I can't, it's not like don't misinterpret that I don't think it was good, but it really just kind of tonally never took off. And
it seems like it's hard, frustrating. If you had not seen the original, I mean, I know that's hard. Would it work as its own movie?
Still did. It's not like I was like missing the other film. It was more just like, oh, I see where you're going. And then it just didn't want to go any further, if you know what I mean. Mm. And it's very uniform. And I always find like I like slow movies, but I also like payoff. You know, so that's when I was talking about It Comes at Night. That movie, give me a big crazy ending, and I probably would have been totally on board. Mm. I could watch something very slow, but if you pay, give me some payoff, and when a movie just cuts to black and says, oh, credits or something, not saying that this does that, it frustrates me. But it's, you know, her craft's great. And also it's not her traditional, you know, her soundtracks are usually the best part of her movie.
Yeah.
This actually has no music like that and just a little bit of score towards the end. So, you know, maybe that flattened it a little for me.
Hmm.
But, you know, some people are going to dig it, but I say go find the Don Siegel. It's a crazy movie. And I do think that original is kind of horror-ish because it's a pretty nightmarish situation the character's in.
Cool. Yeah, but, I just picked it up. I've never seen the original.
Yeah, I think you'll
dig
it.
Got it on Blu-ray.
Nice.
I have a movie that I've been dying to talk with Ryan about for weeks now. A little movie that Scream Factory put out called The Lawnmower Man.
Lawnmower Man.
Yeah, because I know you're a fan, and I'm a fan.
I
don't care what anyone says.
Like, yeah.
I liked it in the theaters first time.
You posted a funny photo of Jeff Fahey without his shirt on, like looking in the mirror. And you're like, this is where I learned my game, whatever your joke was.
Yeah, because it's him looking in the mirror with his shirt off and he's just got these jeans on and he's looking at like a Marlboro ad. And then he's like, hey,
yep.
You got a horse? And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, you could tell that was a special Fahey moment. You know when actors go to acting school and they're like, private moments, explore your private moments. Fahey probably went full private moment. And they were like, Fahey, this is what you got. You got a mirror. You are Job. You got a magazine that's got some cowboys in it. Give us a private moment. What would Job, a heightened Job, do?
There's a really good article on the site that we put up maybe a year ago. It's by this writer named Norberto Gomez, who's a professor. I think he's at Johns Hopkins. He's somewhere near Baltimore. And he explored masculinity in the Lawnmower Man series. He goes through the whole thing.
Wow.
Amongst other things, he explores like the portrayal of technology at the time. But it's like a really in-depth
Whoa.
Exclusive dive, academic dive into the Lawnmower Man series. It's up on our site.
Right. Well, I watched the director's cut because this had a longer cut on it. Yes. I mean, you know, it's technically based on a Stephen King story, but he was so upset that it has one scene from the story that he took his name off of it.
Yeah.
So you're not even allowed to the disc cannot even mention his name. But we all know it's based on a Stephen King story. And quite frankly, it's not that good a story. So the fact that this movie
I love that Stephen King story.
Well, regardless, the fact that
he eats a gopher.
Well, let's just lay the groundwork, so to speak, that the Lawnmower Man short story is just about a guy who has an insane lawnmower man who
eats a gopher.
Who eats a gopher and eats the grass. And
really?
Basically, yeah.
It's weird.
He pukes up the entrails in the bird bath, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, exactly. This is during a time when there was a lot of Stephen King adaptations being made. It had proven to be a big success. Huh. The Stand was a success. There was a lot of Stephen King. A Graveyard Shift came out. And, you know, there was just people were grabbing up titles.
Right.
And in this case, they decided to go down the
PR
path.
It's funny, though, because the last moment of that, without spoiling it, to me, even when I was in theaters as a kid, I remember going, that's a total Stephen King moment. Like, really smart, crazy moment.
No, none of it.
It was literally title alone and the fact that Joe, had
And look, I'm not critiquing the story, but what I'm saying is this. To me, the best adaptations of Stephen King stuff is, it's much harder to take a very giant epic book of his, like The Stand, for example, and to truncate it, or Dark Tower, we'll see, to truncate it into a movie. Whereas the most successful stuff is when it's a short that is expanded to... a feature because you can keep the essence of the Stephen King thing and then bring your own thing to it. A good example.
About Clive Barker stuff, like his short stories, I feel work very, very well as features.
Yeah, because you can get all of it and expand on it with whatever the themes and our idea. I mean, Candyman's a great example of that. 1408, I thought was pretty good, minus the third act, but that's an example. It's a tiny story that they made into a pretty creepy movie. I feel like the fact that they took that little story that you described and that director Brett Leonard came up with this amazing, way ahead of the curve virtual reality storyline.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked it as a kid and I hadn't seen it since then. So I watched the director's cut, which is about 20, 30 minutes longer.
It's
really cool. I really like this movie a lot. I think it's really good. I like Pierce Brosnan in it. I think Jeff Fahey, I remember not relating, but you know what I mean? Like where you feel, I felt such deep sympathy for him, especially when he was a simple guy, because I don't know him. I didn't know he's acting. He just like, and he gradually gets smarter. And you know, it reminded me of Flowers to Algernon and Charlie, which the director mentions. That was totally his inspiration. And I love that story. And he's watching it now as an adult. Like what he does is so amazing. Because I totally believe he's kind of this simpleton. And then at one point, he's like, my intelligence has surpassed yours. And you're just like, whoa. So I just thought it was a super cool movie and I like it. And I just think it's really ambitious for 1992.
Yes, absolutely. And it does a lot more character work than it has any right to do. Because it's a pretty, you know, it's a effects heavy film. And Brett Leonard, who went on to do Virtuosity, he proved to be like more style and visual effects over substance. And with
substance, he makes an opera of pain in Virtuosity.
Lawnmower Man, you know, you set up Pierce Brosnan's, you know, angst. You know, the guy can't even hold down a relationship. They make time for that moment when his wife comes down the stairs and she's like, let's just go to the city. And then he like almost starts to have sex with her. And he's like, my work. I can't right now.
You need to watch the director's cut. Their whole relationship is way more strained than that.
Yeah. And it's like, really? This movie really doesn't need it. But let's not forget Jenny Wright.
From Near Dark.
Yeah, Jenny Wright from Near Dark playing the kind of the
she's
harlot.
She's like the town widow.
The town widow who comes on to Job.
I just remember
as a kid going, whoa, because she has like that seduction scene where she takes she has the power, she takes Job on.
That is the only scene I remember, by the way. I have not seen this in decades.
I felt dirty when I was a kid watching that scene.
So if you had to choose this or Ghost in the Machine?
I don't know.
Lawnmower Man over Ghost in the Machine. Really? You would take the director's cut over the theatrical?
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah. I thought it was because those character moments that you talk about, there's a lot more of them.
And there it's is like, a
you
ton.
Don't, you
a
don't
ton.
Need them, but I like all those scenes because I think Brosnan is so good.
Yeah.
Like this is, you know, before he became the big star that he was.
And he also
was.
Got the kid from Pre-Hysteria in it too. Mm. Isn't that the little kid from Pre-Hysteria?
I thought it was the kid from... I was going to say
he's in something else, but Prehysteria movie. Just comes to mind for some reason.
Anyways, moving on.
So I'll drop a couple really quick ones. I finally saw Wishmaster, which I say I finally saw it because I had never really rushed to see Wishmaster because I'd always thought I'd seen Wishmaster. Mm-hmm. And then we started talking about it in relation to the new film Wish Upon that's coming up. And I was like, let's watch a little Wishmaster. And as we're watching it, I'm like, I've never seen this before.
I love this movie.
I do. It was some moments felt like, hey, guys, we've got $70 million to make a movie. Let's just throw in a plane crash. It's really superfluous. We don't really need it. But let's make that guy a tree. We don't have to explain it, but let's just have a human tree running through the scene. So a lot of it felt kind of like that. But, man, it was fun. Kind of batshit crazy.
I still haven't done the rewatch yet. It's not since theaters.
Neither have I. And I just tweeted this weekend, and people were very excited. Because I have the Wishmaster collection. I haven't made my way through it, but I have seen them. And I just got the Vestron Warlock collection.
I canceled my order on that. I had it on Amazon. I was like, I can't do it.
I
love the first one.
Yeah, the first one's amazing.
Second one's kind of cheesy, but it's got
three.
Some good effects.
I'm not sure if I've seen three. But here's the thing. Everyone has always talked about like, oh, they got to do like Leprechaun versus Wishmaster.
Oh, yeah.
But when I saw them next to each other, I was like, oh my God, I want Wishmaster versus Warlock so bad.
Oh, that's much better.
It's like they've got these two collections. Come on, Lionsgate Vestron. This is your original feature. The next one has to be.
So that was my quick Wishmaster. I also saw Life, which Ryan has already seen. Yeah. I think Elric saw too. I didn't mind it. I will say it wasn't groundbreaking. Like, speaking of tentacle monsters, it didn't do anything that I was like, oh, I've never seen this before. But I enjoyed it. And
it's
I ate popcorn.
Yeah, it's okay.
I was kind of cool with it. But the big one that I saw that I will do is Virus from 1999.
I feel like you talk about that every week, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I have not talked about it since 1999. For some reason, I remembered this movie. I saw it in the 90s, and I saw this one in theaters.
Donald Sutherland, New Zealand's Cliff
like,
Curtis.
Yeah, as like a weird sea captain and Jamie Lee Curtis.
I remember it.
Who disowned the movie and like spoke out against it. And I remember it being a lot better. I will say the effects are still really good. And like the robots, the bit that they build, the human robots are really cool looking. I remember the movie being a lot better than it was.
This is why we love you.
Somebody had to go there. And I'm not going to go into one, but I just wanted to recommend for all those people watching Twin Peaks and enjoying Twin Peaks.
Yes.
I did watch the Lynch Art Life documentary.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And what I will say is, because I've literally...
On Amazon Prime right
Amazon
now.
Prime, I've literally watched every of them. There's been about three or maybe even four over his career major documentaries on him, not just like extras. Pretty as a Picture was the first one, kind of him at his prime, really good. This one's my favorite because what it is, it's so simple. It's really just him basically painting and just doing art. It's really not about his films at all, unlike his other documentaries. And it's his voiceover and telling directly to camera on a little microphone like this, really personal stories about his childhood. And some of them are amazing. Like him talking about his dad and just little experiences that totally made him who he is. And the Blue Velvet memory of seeing a naked battered woman walking down the street when he's like six with his brother. And like, they're terrified because they don't understand what's happening.
Yeah.
I loved it because of that. It's very simple. It's not the most interesting visually, but man, I thought it was really neat and it's perfect time to watch it because as you're watching Twin Peaks, you really see that this is like an artist untethered, like, and some episodes are good and some are don't really work and some are fucking batshit amazing and you like most incredible thing you could ever see, and but you don't understand a lot of it's explained when you're watching him talk and the way he thinks and paints, I think. So I thought it's good timing to check it out.
Nice.
I just want to talk about the double feature I quickly did on the plane on the way back. I saw The Final Girls, which I've talked about on a show before.
Awesome.
And Nerve with Emma Roberts.
Good soundtrack. I haven't seen the film.
Really?
Soundtrack's really cool.
You haven't seen the film yet?
I haven't seen the film.
The film is excellent.
Oh,
I think it's really, really well
done.
What's
it called? Nerve?
Nerve. And it's basically Emma Roberts is just kind of a goody two-shoes, you know, girl who lives by the rules. And then she gets swept up in this internet game in which you you download an app and you say that you're going to participate in a slew of games that other people tell you to do, like other dares or other acts of danger. And she winds up teaming up with one of the Franco brothers. And off
Dave
Frank, thank you. They go off into the big city and they perform all these crazy acts. And it escalates as you go along. So you kind of play into the wish fulfillment of, oh, I'm going to do this, or, oh, I'm going to kiss a total stranger. I want to do, and it just keeps getting more and more dangerous as this like kind of cult of gamers start to make themselves more and more present. And I got to tell you, it was incredibly effective. The directors who did that film did Paranormal Activity 3, which
Catfish.
Is Catfish, and
it looked very visually inventive and like kind of exciting.
It was. That was the thing. It was poppy. It moved fast. Yeah. It was visually stimulating. Ah. And both Franco and Emma Roberts had really great chemistry. And then the final girls, guys, if you have not seen The Final Girl, see it. This is my like third time watching it. It holds up and it makes me laugh every single time. And
I
it's such a love. Yeah.
Oh my God.
There's one moment in this movie in the third act where it's like kind of a goodbye scene. And I literally was like, I'm getting emotional. This is dumb. But it works so fucking well. It works so well.
So you watch movies on planes. I read.
I have my iPad and sometimes I'm done reading scripts.
For a cinema. You go.
I was going to tell you something really nerdy about The Final Girls, which is, it's not related to this, but it's our listeners will appreciate it. Basically, I went to go see Okja at New Beverly.
Did you cry? Because I cried.
Don't tell
it's
me.
Great.
I
gotta it's great.
Something.
It's
really
great.
I bawled my fucking eyes
It's really, really great. It's the new film by
Bong Joon-ho.
Who did Snowpiercer and Mother and Memories of Murder. A lot of great Korean films. Anyway, they made a print of it for the new Bev. Mm-hmm. So I went to go see it, and outside I bumped into the writers of The Final Girls.
Josh and Mark.
And Josh Miller was in, he's in a lot of movies as a kid, Near Dark and Pretty. But his dad was...
Teen Witch.
Yeah, Teen Witch.
And he was on the show.
And he was on the show. But his dad is, Father Karras from The Exorcist. And then I go into the theater, and they're sitting behind us, and a few rows over is Oz Perkins, who says hello to me. And I was with my Josh Miller.
<That's>
I was like, two Josh Miller just like, what is? And I'm like, dude, we're about to watch a movie at the new Bev, like from Netflix. The sons of the guys from Psycho and Exorcist. Yeah. Like, I don't know, this is nerdy for me.
That is pretty crazy.
Cool.
We'll just let the record show that Ryan has said that Nerve is very good and said the game is okay. So in terms of the gamers, let the cinema police descend on your souls.
Throwing
you under the bus.
Wow.
All right.
I haven't forgotten that game disc.
Lay me to waste.
Wow.
Love the game, guys.
Alrighty, okay, but we're going to wrap it up. Really quickly, I just want to say, obviously we did a bunch of bonus episodes in between the break. Please go back and listen to them. Me and Ryan were saying, I think people are adverse to the word bonus.
Yeah.
They see bonus and they're like, I don't know about that. But they're all a lot of fun. We did summer themes.
Yeah.
And I only bring that up because I literally just watched The Burning, Madman, The Final Terror, Just Before Dawn. I did a marathon on them. My roommate had not seen any of them. So literally, I think it was 104 degrees. Like, we need to watch The Burning because today we are Cropsy.
Nice.
And we just watched them all in a row.
Yeah.
And then you did one that was horror films based on true tales.
Kind of. We did, we called it True Tales of Horror, but we did four stories in the episode. We do the town that Silent Hill is based on. So we explore the real town of Centralia that's burning from underneath. And then we did the story of when Nosferatu was sued by Dracula.
Yes.
The original Nosferatu film, and how it had like such a shaky release because Dracula sued the shit out of it and everything that went down there. And then we did the story of how the chainsaw was invented, which is absolutely horrifying and gut-churning. And then I don't remember what we did for our fourth one.
Well,
it was
listen
awesome.
In. Strange but True Tales from Horror Movies. Now available on iTunes. And don't forget to leave a review for us. Find us on social media. Add us on your Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Let's bring out our guest.
Let's do it.
Today's sponsor is Shudder, the premium streaming video service devoted to horror, thrillers, and suspense. Backed by AMC Networks, Shudder has a growing and dynamic selection of thrilling premieres, originals, and exclusives, including Rob Zombie's 31, The Ring vs. The Grudge franchise mashup, Sadako vs. Kayoko, and is the only place to see the highly influential Ghostwatch.
Exclusively on Shudder is Among the Living from the directors of the French classic Inside and never released in the United States until now. Among the Living, when three boys skip school to wander an abandoned film studio, they stumble upon a woman in chains being dragged by a man in a clown mask. Before they can escape, they see something that's been hidden for years, which they were not meant to see. Among the Living is now streaming only on Shudder.
Ooh, Shudder is available on the web, iOS, Android, Chromecast, Apple TV, Roku, and starting this month, Xbox One and Amazon Fire TV and Fire TV Stick for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But Shockwave's listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. That is one free month. Just enter SHOCK at checkout.
Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of horror available to stream anywhere. And just enter Shock at checkout and get your free month.
All right, I want to welcome a special guest that we have, Mr. John Leonetti. You may recognize his name attached to such films as The Conjuring and Annabelle and this week's release. This comes out this week, Wish Upon. John and I had met when he was doing press for Annabelle, and we were stuck in a room doing the usual kind of video junket in which you have 3 minutes to rattle off as many questions as you can and get as much rich content as you can from your interviewer interviewee as you can. And
I bet you don't miss those days.
No, I don't. But I remember sitting down and doing my research ahead of time and looking at John's vast body of work. And you know, it reaches back from The Mask to Elvira to Mortal Kombat. It's like, what haven't you put your fingers on? And you're a guest that we've been wanting to have on for a while. So welcome, John.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here, actually.
We usually kick off with, and I think, you know, you began your career as a DP, correct? Or did you I was going to say, were you a camera assistant first? Worked your way up the ranks?
My father's had a rental business, movie equipment rental business. And he was like I guess you could say he was a visionary in our industry behind the scenes and the technical end.
So you kind of grew up in all this. Like you grew up around the cameras.
Oh, 100%. My dad was an electrician on The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, wow.
My dad gaffed Singing in the Rain.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Wow, that is really
awesome.
Special.
It's he passed away at 98 about, my God, maybe 5-6 years ago or something like that. And incredible stories about him. And, you know, I just grew up in an Italian Catholic household where they have a family business and you start working in it when you're 13. But I was like crawling on electrical cable when I was 6 years old, you know, at the shop. And randomly, I worked on my first film when I was 15, actually.
What film was that?
It was called A Book of Numbers. It was a all-black movie. Raymond St. Jacques was the director and star. My brother was the camera operator. My brother, Matt, is 15 years older than me, and he's a very accomplished cinematographer, if you don't know about him. I was just on vacation in Dallas, Texas, in the summer when it was so freaking hot, and for 2 weeks. And I knew how to load magazines, camera magazines, because I'd worked in the camera department. I'd worked in the grip department, electrical department. I dabbled in all of it because that's what you do. And
Was there any pushback from you, like from you growing up as like a rebellious maybe youth going, I'm not going to follow in my dad's footsteps.
Forget this,
family
Dad.
Business.
I'm going to be a dentist.
Forget movies, man.
You know, the thing I was really rebelling against that I couldn't go to the beach every day in the summer anymore. That's what pissed me off. Because I was going to, you know, Pier 11, Lifeguard Station 11 at right in Muscle Beach in Santa Monica. That's where I grew up. And then that 13-year came, and it was like, you're going to work, kid. And it was after school. It was on Saturdays. I mean, I just haven't stopped working kind of since in a way. But, you know, it was weird. I really loved it. I got a BA in business economics. Okay. I went to UCSB I took two film classes like the whole time just for fun. Mm. And I just actually the last 2 years of college, I put myself through college. I paid for my tuition, my room and board, and still had enough fun drugs left over to share with my friends from all the money I made. But it was really cool, and it was part of the work ethic. But I slowly and surely realized that it was my calling. Actually, it's kind of weird. I when I was a kid, I loved to paint and draw, and it started out with like monsters and dragster cars or something, and then eventually it turned into like portraits and other things, and then real cars came along and girls, and that art stuff went out the window. But I kind of had this sort of innate love for art and light and framing. And randomly, then I became an assistant at 18 years old. I was got in the union, which is really young to get in the union.
I was going to say, you were in the camera union by 18.
By 18, which is crazy. In those days, that's like really young. Maybe the youngest ever in those days, just saying.
Yeah.
But and it was all just – it just went that way. I don't know anything else than this, really. Yeah. Yeah. And so
that's incredible. That's incredible. Well, when you were first assistant camera, I mean, I kind of want to throw a little bit of focus on the horror stuff that you worked sure. on, because it goes back quite a ways. Poltergeist.
Oh my God!
I mean, you were first assistant camera.
I was,
and just to kind of shed some light on our listeners.
Yeah.
You know,
what are you shedding light on?
No. When you're
where are you going?
Answering
with this?
Questions. No, no, no. For
talking
us?
About just in terms of what a first assistant camera does.
Sure.
Just explain a little bit.
Okay. Well, actually, you know,
because you are definitely the eyes and ears, because you're glued right there to into the middle
baby.
Of the action.
I got a few stories for you.
I bet.
And please. Also, who directed it? But yeah, continue. Yeah.
Well, I can tell you that too.
Some lovers go slow, Elric. Some just jump right
no,
in.
No, Elric's just going to jump into that pool right now.
Well, I'll tell you. Not only did I – was I the focus puller, Matt, my brother, was the cinematographer, okay? Wow. And we had our family Ultracam camera. We developed and competed with Panavision and MovieCam and Aeroflex with the movie camera that we built ourselves. And that cool. – and with our own anamorphic lenses that we put together – with Henry Kosciuszko of Technovision in Rome in those days. That's a whole other chapter in the book of my life. But anyway, I was a focus puller. And I actually made depth of field charts, my own depth of field charts for every one of those lenses. What you do is when you're a focus puller, you're responsible for keep the camera working, but you're really responsible for keeping everybody in focus in a creative, in a very technical way. And it's like a sport. It's like eye-hand coordination. Mm-hmm. And it's – but you are always – you're right, by the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And – the really cool thing about Poltergeist was I'll never forget the very first day I walked on the set, the shooting set, and there were 4x8 foam core boards with 8.5x11 storyboards on them. Mm-hmm. And I had never seen that like that
right.
before. And, you know, it was a very – very intense, very fun, very technical movie to work on. There's a lot going on. And candidly, Steven Spielberg directed that movie.
Yeah.
There's no question. Mm. However, Toby Hooper, I adore. I love that man so much. But if I'd have known you were going to ask me that question, I would have brought a picture I have, which is one picture of the whole movie in one shot. And it's
wow.
It's the scene where the tree comes in and grabs the boy mm-hmm. out of the bedroom.
Yeah.
And we have two cameras lined up. The tree's coming in, like from pictures like this, right to left. And boy's in the bed, right, you know, here. And the cameras are behind. And in the foreground on an apple box is Toby. And he's like this.
Oh.
And then
mouth wide again.
For those of you at home, he was excited and kind of shocked.
Yeah, and standing like right to the left and behind him is Spielberg pointing. And then there's my brother behind him like this is the cinematographer. Yeah.
Now your brother was the cinematographer.
He was a cinematographer and I was a focus puller. And, you know, I was a second assistant as well. And that's, you know, previous to that, that's what, you know, that's where you mark the feet and you hit the clapperboard and you make sure the film, in those days, the film magazines were loaded. We don't do that anymore.
Right.
Whole different deal. But I went through every step and that experience was really cool. It was a very serious focus pulling job. It got very competitive and I could tell you, we could spend almost a half hour on the stories from that movie, I'm probably sure. alone. But
what was what in terms of scenes to tackle? What was the most exciting or the?
We had that crazy
toughest?
Light, that crazy light effect, which is always that with is, the mirrors. And,
okay, that yeah. was that was my brother
ever, yeah.
and Pat Blindmeyer, who was my brother's gaffer for like 30 years. Who God rest his soul, he's passed on. Not my brother, but Pat, who's one of the craziest persons you've ever met in your life. Amazing dude. They came up with this idea to take a bed, you know, a box spring from a bed, mm-hmm. and take all the stuff off and just leave the springs. And they put vibrator motors on them, and they broke up mirrors and put them on there, and they shot xenons into them from behind. You know, right, it was in the closet. But that's when they filled the room up with smoke, and we did it that way.
Wow. So
wow. Yeah. Now, I remember that movie had a lot of, I'll call it a roving camera, just kind of moving through the space of the house constant. Like, was it a difficult film?
Mostly Dolly.
Okay.
In those days, it was mostly Dolly. Yeah, it was Dolly. Dennis Matsuda was operator, and I was on focus. We did, but one amazing thing, we did the very first, like, well, for me, well, not the first, you know, Dolly zoom in history, but I don't know if you remember how the whole hallway stretched. Mm-hmm. And it was the very first time ever using what's called a micro force zoom control, which is still being used today. It was a fighter jet button that you use to, like, you know, use to control fighter jets. Yeah. And they put that trigger thingy on there. And then they put this, anyway, these servo motors and all this BS, magnetic motors, whatever, or brushless motors. And it was crazy. It was so cool running down that hallway, making that son of a bitch stretch as Joe Beth was trying to get away, you know. Really fun stuff.
So it was mostly a fun set, or was it also just an intense set? Just
both.
Okay.
Spielberg, Steven, after work, was the nicest guy on the planet. We'd even go to his house in Beverly Hills and watch dailies at his house. Huh. It was pretty cool. On the set, he was very intense. And he was also, well, I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. He was kind of in love with Jo Beth Williams, and he was always flirting with her.
Well, yeah. Pretty funny. Who wouldn't? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I can't.
That's amazing.
It's not a bad thing.
No,
it's not a bad thing. And that's nothing against him, but that was pretty cute. But it got pretty intense. And, I mean, actually, he loved to want to operate the camera. Okay?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And for some reason, he would give the camera crew, that myself and the camera operator, Dennis, and the dolly grip, Mark Averill. God rest his soul. He's passed on. But a lot of shit. He called us the Three Stooges. So we ended up calling him Shep, the Fourth Stooge.
Nice.
Because there was a scene. I don't remember there. She's taking a bath in the bathtub. Mm-hmm. Okay. And there's mirrors like all around. Right. And so I just remember this is before video assist. So to pull focus, I had to get down really low with my hand and just peeking up just because we hid the camera, you know, so you couldn't see it. And I couldn't see what the camera was seeing. Normally, when I'm standing up, I have a very good idea, you know, if I could see what's in the mirrors. We went to dailies, and the camera was in like six mirrors, and Spielberg was operating. So now we could call him Shep. Just saying. And I admire the man so much. Yeah, don't get me wrong.
Of course.
But these are stories that are like, I mean, oh my God, I can go on and on and on.
Well, how was Hooper's temperament through all of this.
So nice. Yeah. He was just glad to be there. I mean, what happened was it was really more of a setup because Steven developed the movie.
Sure.
And it was his to direct, except there was anticipation of a director's strike. So if he was the producer, mm-hmm. But really he directed it in case there was going to be a strike, and Toby was cool with that. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't really anything against Toby.
Right.
Every once in a while he would actually leave the set and let Toby do a few things just because, but really Steven directed it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think deep down everyone knew that. I mean, there's a couple of gross parts like with the weird faces melting that I always thought, oh, that seems
the
more like a Toby moment.
Yeah.
You know? And,
well, he creatively had input.
Yeah.
He did. And I hope that I'm not telling tales out of school. I mean, it's nothing against Toby. He's a great guy, great director in his own right, you know?
Yeah. But we've always wanted to know, so you just satisfied that.
Well, in the wake of Poltergeist, you know, you worked on so many other great films. Weird Science.
Weird Science.
Oh,
baby.
That's one of Rob's favorite movies. John Hughes. You worked with John Hughes?
I did, man.
And Ridgemont High.
And Fast Times.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That was... You know, Fast Times actually, we relate to Wish Upon, and we could talk about that a little bit that point. But it's the thing about Fast Times is today, it's timeless still. And when my kids were in high school, which is a few years ago now, you know, I had them watch it. And it reminded me how timeless it was about what kids go through in high school. And oh my God, working on that film was. really fun. Amy Heckerling was the director, mm-hmm. and you know, it was her first time directing, and she just had this great instinct with character and fun, and my brother was the DP on that one too, and so he helped her quite a bit, but only as the DP does, you know. And she really did a great job directing it. But my claim to fame in 45, 46, 7 years working in the business on Fast Times is, you know, there's the scene where they go on a field trip with the class, and that goofy teacher guy was holding up like a heart, a biology heart or something like that. And it was scripted, "Oh, gross." And I just blurted out, "No, that's gnarly." And they look at me and they go, and so gnarly, they changed it to gnarly. And I got gnarly on the screen.
Nice.
Amazing. Oh.
Gnarly,
dude. You are the origin of gnarly.
Yeah.
That's so funny you mention it, because I honestly have not seen Fast Times in God knows how long.
Right.
And literally, I watched it this week. It was literally poking out of my collection. I was like, I haven't seen Fast Times in years. Yeah. And I pulled it out, and I always, my memory as a kid always kind of mixes it up and associates it with, you know, things like Porky's and Revenge of the Nerds, like kind of like the over the top sexual comedies. I watching it now as an adult, I couldn't believe how timeless it was. It's real and honest.
It's very honest.
It's a beautifully made film and executed. So it's fresh in my head, which is amazing.
That is amazing.
And everyone is in that movie. Like everyone at the beginning of the career.
Oh, yeah.
Jennifer Jason Leigh, Nick Cage, Sean Penn.
Oh, my God.
Judge Reinhold. Everyone yeah. is in that thing.
Really.
But what about how was Weird Science? Because I don't think that's out of line in a horror show. There's some nice little horror elements.
It's a Frankenstein retelling, as far as I'm concerned.
That's true.
But how was Hughes to work with?
He was amazing. You know, he'd shoot just tons of film. I mean, he would just let the camera roll and roll and roll and roll, which was really interesting to me. But he's a really smart guy. He was a really smart guy. I mean, I remember sitting on the couch one day, you know, in between the lighting setup next to him, and we were talking, and you know, he said, "Oh yeah, I wrote a script last weekend." I mean, he wrote a whole script in a weekend.
Wow.
And I just said to myself, "You got to be kidding me." Mm-hmm. He's that smart. He really was that brilliant. And he was very nice. You know, someone that smart, they're a little into their, you know, in their own place,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
sort of, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it was so fun. I had one of the funnest experiences for me on that movie was there was a scene where Kelly LeBrock was taking a shower. And after every take, you know, the suds would come off, and someone would have to put the suds back on her back, and she's in a bikini underwear and pasties on her nipples, and I'm right there as the focus pillar, and I was just the most convenient person, so I got to reapply the suds.
Oh, you guys!
And
so
you guys,
amazing.
I'm telling you,
to the most perfect.
Oh
that was
gosh.
It. Oh my God!
It's you and Steven Seagal, and that's it. You've gone next to Kelly LeBrock.
You got it, buddy.
That's pretty awesome.
I wanted that to be in the credits. Kelly LeBrock assistant.
That's great.
Since we're on Weird Science, I need to ask because I've never I thought I read this somewhere and I never got the full thing, but did they shoot a ton of the movie with a different girl before Kelly LeBrock? Did she replace somebody? Because I thought I read that there was a completely different girl and that they shot for a while, like maybe a week or two or something like
that.
You
know, now that you say that, God, that could be, but it wasn't very long. I really feel like a fool because I don't really quite – I kind of remember that, but –
I also don't know if that's public knowledge or if that was a rumor that I read somewhere, and maybe they don't want to reveal that for the sake of the ego of the other actress.
It wasn't for very long if it happened, because I really don't remember that. And I was there the whole movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I wish I could answer more, but
that's all right.
I don't know.
So the first film that you were a director of, the first horror film that you were a director of photography on was Child's Play 3.
Yes, that's
so
true.
Yeah, yeah. What, you know, coming to the table having worked with Spielberg and all these filmmakers up to that point, you know, obviously you want to kind of set it your own look for on a horror film, you know, a film that's a third in a franchise. You know, was it a big challenge?
It was for a few reasons, but – you know, instinctually, I think, and I still go by this today, you have to approach it realistically.
Yeah.
And the lighting and the look. I really believe that's super important. And
you're lighting a human or a doll.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. And I mean,
Mortal Kombat.
That little fucker Chucky, you know, that little guy. I mean, it was so funny, like working with the puppeteers and, you know, he would stand in for himself because he's a puppet, right?
Yeah.
So there's times when, you know, I'd say, you know, Chucky, you know, turn your head this way, you know, to look at the light or whatever. And he just flipped me off. And it was like, really? I would just crack up, man. And it was so, you know, you get to be pretty intimate with those puppeteers because you spend so many hours with them. They were amazing. Sure. Amazing. And, you know, I think we created a pretty creepy sort of tone in that movie. Yeah. But looking back at it, I just remember I wanted it to be natural and real. And I think it was. It's been a long time since I've looked at that.
It's been a while since I've looked at Child's Play 3 specifically. Yeah. I haven't seen that in a while.
It's almost time for a marathon with that new one coming out.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, the new one's coming out soon.
How did you start the relationship working with James Wan? Because it's obviously, I mean, that's like four films?
Five in a row.
Five in a row.
And then
with
Annabelle.
Sounds.
And then Annabelle, yeah.
You were coming right off The Woods beforehand, right? Which is Lucky McKee. I love that movie so much.
And I love him, by the way.
The cinematography in that is gorgeous, I have to say, because it's all those woods and that old school. Is that what kind of alerted James of your awesome work, or?
It's interesting. The reason why we met, first of all, to be candid, is I was a Universal boy. I had shot I shot Scorpion King before that. I'd shot what else did I shoot before that?
I have your filmography here. But,
but it was like Scorpion King and whatever. And that was kind of a big movie. And they wanted to put an experienced person with James on Dead Silence because it was, you know, it's his first, you know, big movie. I mean, Saw would killed it. But, you know, I was like, you know, film school going really well.
Yeah.
I mean, amazing as it should be. But, I mean, James is obviously quite brilliant and all that. But, you know, they wanted to ensure their investment to a degree, of course. So I interviewed with him. And candidly, we just creatively hit it off. I mean, I'm not sure. It's trying to remember what it stuck out. He loved The Mask. I know he loved that. There was things about The Mask he loved. And
I'm sure James asked all the same questions we're asking.
Yeah.
So what was it like working with Kelly LeBrock?
Oh my God. Yeah. He's heard them all by now. My God. Whatever. After five movies, he's heard it all. But he's a good guy.
But it's one thing to get that first gig, but to want to then make, you know, every successive movie together. Yeah. What's the creative juice when you're on set together that kind of worked?
Yeah, because from what I understand, Dead Silence was rather difficult on him. He's been pretty candid about that. I like the way the movie turned out quite a bit.
You know, I actually think Dead Silence was a cool movie, but there was an inherent problem with the script, and honestly, the original script was better than when they brought someone to come in and rewrite it. And the person who came in to rewrite it is an awesome script writer, but just didn't get it right. But when you pay someone $350,000 for 2 weeks, then the studio says this must be good, so they just did it. Not saying any more than that. And I honestly think that's what hurt the movie ultimately. Because anyway, but James and I, we formed a visual sort of language together over that movie and Death Sentence.
Yeah.
Very different movies. Death Sentence, I think, is a really good movie.
Yeah, I think that's one of his most underrated ones.
It's super intense. Yeah. And there's the thing about James, he's very visual, but he also I think he wanted to learn a little bit about how to tell the story with a camera a little bit. And maybe I helped him a little bit with that, even though he has awesome instincts. So, you know, he's, like I say, he's a little genius in his own right. But we formed, what happened was we experimented together on those films, and it's more random, I think, how we collaborated, but it was really, really fun because we both have a lot of energy and passion about what we do. And then Insidious came along, and which is kind of what helped start
Blumhouse,
baby. Yeah. Here you go. Yeah. I mean, aside from Paranormal, Insidious 1 helped put this place right on the map, to be very candid, and in a cool way. And you know, we made it for $1 million and the rest is history. Okay. But it's what we learned because we're kind of forced to on how to tell a story with one camera. And to be able to go in any room at any time and shoot in continuity. Mm-hmm. How do you do that in a movie? Okay. And it's kind of like necessity is the mother of invention and can be really awesome. And I think that's what happened with us in terms of, you know, being able to bring the audience along with you and through literally with you in a story, okay, not just metaphorically. And so we lit both of the houses in the movie practically. And we created kind of a technique on how to simulate the rest of the light very natural as well. And I could get into the technical part of that, but the bottom line is it was an experiment and it worked. And we carried that then on to The Conjuring, which was a $19 million version of Insidious in a way. And that's a whole other experience, which is super cool.
But The Conjuring, it doesn't feel, it feels more sepia toned.
It is.
Okay. Yeah.
When I say it is, it's more desaturated. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's not as much desaturation in Insidious. It was more done just with, it was slightly desaturated. It was The Conjuring where we really start, because it was a period thing. Mm-hmm. And that was our way to still light it very naturally, light it with practicals, and then and be able to bring the audience through. I mean, that opening scene of introducing that house in The Conjuring, you know, that shot, it's really three shots that we put together. It seems like one. It's epic because the farmhouse was, we actually built on stage the whole interior of that. And we had the practical one on the set, you know, mm-hmm. on a practical location. And then we shot backings for like 280 degrees of it in the actual place. And I shot them in a very, very specific way. A very specific color temperature to simulate exactly what happens in real life in the color balance between interior and exterior mm-hmm. light. And it's so freaking real. You cannot tell when we were one or the other. And that was, you know, that's just what you do as a cinematographer. If you get it right, it makes you pretty happy.
I love that the ghost of Poltergeist is really echoed in both those movies too. I imagine the experiences of Poltergeist must have helped with Insidious in terms of being in small spaces, and because mm-hmm. there's definitely some similarities in a good way, you know.
No, that's true. Innately, I mean, I honestly don't know if I've ever thought about that, but I think you're right in that. Yeah, I do.
I think Insidious, honestly, I mean, I think it's one of the coolest horror films the last like 20 years. Like, it just it felt like punk rock in a way, but it's funny because then it became your parents because it became the film.
Yeah.
And that's rare that it comes from a place that's so outsider, but really becomes the mainstream.
How did you approach shooting The Further? Because I know fog in general tends to be kind of the bane of cinematography because sometimes it'll suck up the light when other times it'll refract it. So and this is literally all you have. You literally just have fog. So how did you even approach that?
Well, we had fog and we had one lantern.
Nice.
And that was it.
And the audience's imagination.
And that's right. And again, necessity is the mother of invention. And it's like, you know, James, we were trying to figure it out. Like, what can we do to make this cool? And then all of a sudden, you know, I, with the art department, we tried a few different lanterns and found this freaking lantern that we even try, you know, so oftentimes you'll take and make a movie lantern where you take a peanut bulb or a baby junior bulb or a, you know, 750 bulb or whatever. And you had electricians wire it themselves and you can control it on a dimmer. And, you know, we did everything we could to try and make an even brighter one. I mean, we could not improve on the $20, you know, thing from Big Five.
Wow.
And I still have the original in my house as a keepsake of one of the very originals. Because when you go in The Further now, you can stretch reality. You are stretching reality. So you can stretch the dynamic range of the chip, and I guess you could call it now, because by then we're shooting digital. Mm-hmm. That was on a red camera, that one. It's really interesting because when you get closer to that light, you let it go. Don't be afraid, you know. Don't balance it, you know. And just having that understanding, and then it's really simple. It's like, shoot, that's awesome too, you know. It's weird. You just come. We again, necessity is mother invention, and we just we jived on that, man. We really jived.
Did he suggest to you the idea of directing? It was like getting in the directing chair yourself, or was that something you always wanted to try?
You know, well, he knew that I had directed Mortal Kombat Annihilation previous. And he loved Mortal Kombat, and he got a kick out of that movie. I don't, you know, I like the first movie better than the second movie personally. I think it's a better movie, and I was involved in both of them. And not that I did such a bad job directing it, but there's reasons why, in my opinion, why it's not as good of a movie, and I'll be the first one to admit it. First of all, we should have had Christopher Lambert. Nothing against James Remar. He's awesome, dude.
Lambert's the man.
Well, he's the man. And how can you not have the man? It's Raiden come back. But that's a whole other discussion, you know. But I don't know. James – wait, ask the question again. Sorry.
Well, I was just wondering. I didn't know if it was his suggestion that you try getting the director.
Well, what happened was he knew that – I'd done some television directing also before that. And he knew that I had that in me. And they brought it up. I did not ask to do that. They suggested it. And I went, hell yeah. Especially once I read that script, I went, oh, this is cool shit.
You know, and about Annabelle.
Yeah, Annabelle. Yeah, right.
But is that once you go down that? I mean, I know some people never circle back to be cinematographers once they start directing. Is that something? And now you're on your second, your third film, but second in a row.
No, that's true.
How do you feel about it now?
Oh, that's what I'm supposed to do for the rest of my life. Now I'm a director. I am. I mean, would I shoot? I went back and shot the reshoots and additional photography for Conjuring 2 because the original cinematographer wasn't available. And James just asked me if I would do it. So when all the nun stuff is what I shot in that movie.
Oh, wow.
All? you mean the thing that made the film?
The scariest scenes of the movie?
Whatever.
Everyone loves those parts.
So Annabelle comes and goes, and you're probably looking at a bunch of scripts. Wolves at the Door came out.
Wolves at the Door is an anomaly. That I'm actually really proud of that movie, even though it's only 72 minutes long.
It's very short.
There's a longer version of it, which I prefer, but that's a whole other discussion. That was a movie that people wanted it to be a horror movie, but it's based on something that's really true.
Right.
And you can't – it's not – in my opinion, it was always a drama that was very sad and very – told a very horrific story. And it's let's face it. When all the people you get invested in die and one of them is a mother that's got a – you know, 2 weeks from having a baby, it's in a very interesting thing to deal with. Now, the experience of shooting it was – awesome. And we shot that in continuity. I mean, completely in continuity. And it was so amazing. I mean, but like I say, I'm really proud of that movie. But that is an anomaly. Okay. And it always will be in my directing career.
Right.
Then Wish Upon.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was going to get to you in terms of how the script for Wish Upon came around.
Yeah.
I mean, was it just through a relationship with Broad Green? Did they send you the script?
No.
I mean, how did.
No, actually, Cheryl Clark, our producer, I had met her actually first time at a. I went in an interview with Catherine Hardwick and her for Plush, Blumhouse movie.
Oh, yeah.
And as a shooter, it never worked out that I did it. For whatever reasons, doesn't matter. We just didn't work out.
Before my time.
Whatever. Yeah. But I think Cheryl thought, well, maybe there's something about me or whatever. And then we met after Annabelle. She brought me in for just like a general meeting. But we talked about a movie specifically for me to direct. That was a directing deal. And we hit it off really quite well. And then she sent me the script. And then I read it, a version of Wish Upon, which was a good script. It was very good. Barbara Marshall is an awesome writer. Pardon me, but I didn't know what I wanted to do at that point, and I was juggling a few things, and I didn't like just jump on it. But about 4 months later, she sent it another draft because I wasn't like, okay, let's do this. And it was a little different. It was a little better, but it was still wasn't that much better because it was already quite good. And then I went, And I read it 2 days later. I read it again, and then it put a curse on me. Literally, I said, wow, I get this thing. I get it. And I want to do this. And I had to think about it. You know, I'm like a 59-year-old guy directing a teen, fantasy thriller. I mean, is that my zone? Am I contemporary enough to do that?
Wes Craven did it.
Well, no, exactly.
Yeah. Several times.
Yeah. No, you're right. But I really had to go, because, you know, if I'm going to direct something, I'm going to make sure I'm appropriate, obviously, But that's how it kind of happened. And got to tell you, it was a super fun experience.
And you brought back Joey King.
I did.
From Conjuring.
Yep. She was my suggestion. The moment I read Claire, which is the essence of what makes that movie in so many levels, then that character is, you know, just many layers of an onion that I think is really cool. And that's one of the reasons, main reasons why I wanted to do it. But I was mesmerized by Joey when she was sitting on that bed in The Conjuring and just staring at that black corner near that door going, there's someone there, you know, and it's like, whoa. I told my wife, that girl's going somewhere. And immediately, first person I thought of, I mentioned it to them, bam, she became Claire, which was awesome.
Yeah. And Ryan Phillippe.
And Ryan. Oh, my
God. A little Ryan Phillippe in this film. Yeah. How was he to work with?
Amazing. He's.
I've met with him only once before. He's a really nice guy.
He is.
You know, and he's on the Shooter right now.
And, he is, and he's doing really well. And he's directing some.
He's
producing. And, you know, Ryan is a really smart guy. He's been at this a long time too. And having him on the set, you just know that his suggestions are going to come with a lot of thought. Mm-hmm. And they do. Mm-hmm. And I love him. We're buds. We are truly buds. And I can't wait for us to work together again. He did a really nice job in the movie, I think. Really nice job.
And who shot Wish Upon?
Okay. A guy named Michael Galbraith.
Okay.
Now, this goes back to interesting. I've shot and directed 13 movies in Canada in my career, I would say.
Right.
The very first one was a movie I loved doing, which Adam Rifkin directed, which is Detroit Rock City. Such a fun movie.
Yeah.
And he was the gaffer. And randomly, and even in those days, he was like the best gaffer or one of them, if not the top two in Toronto. And he still is. He does the hugest movies there as a gaffer, but he also shoots. And I actually, my God, this is 10 years ago at least. He said, "John, I want to dabble in cinematography as well. And would you give me a recommendation on a TV thing?" And I said, "Hell yeah, man!" So I wrote a letter for him, and he got the job. And you know, we stayed in touch. And he gaffed Dead Silence, and he gaffed not Honey. Oh, he gaffed The Perfect Man for Universal. And he also gaffed for my brother before as well. And he's a filmmaker. He's really smart, and he gets lighting like no tomorrow. He's one of the best gaffers I've ever worked with. And even my brother said that, and believe me, my brother is super critical. Even though my brother and I, you know, come from different lighting styles, Michael is good for either.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? So it says a lot for Michael. And then I just got to say, I mean, he's doing my next film as well.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's going to be in Toronto. I mean, I'm literally leaving in a couple of weeks to go there and with the same crew almost.
What film is that?
Oh, it's called The Silence.
Okay.
It's something I've been working on over a year with Alexandra Milshin, optioned this book called The Silence by Tim Lebbins. And
I know Tim Lebbins. Yes.
My God. Yeah. It's awesome. Yeah. And this is a really good script written by the Van Dyke brothers, Shane and Carrie Van Dyke.
Yeah, they're great.
They are. And they're the, you know, Dick Van Dyke's grandsons, actually, which is kind of cool.
And they look like him.
They do, actually.
When you sit them in a room side by side, there's like characteristics. They're not 100%,
That's true.
If you combine them, you got Dick Van Dyke.
You got Dick. That's so funny. That's so true.
Yeah.
They're really good guys, too. And we've been working on it. Originally, we always knew it was a no-brainer as a movie, but we thought this could be a cool 8-episode TV show too. And what it is, it's if you want to know, the Discovery Channel scientists uncover a cave that's been closed up for maybe a million years.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Long, long, long time. And as they're finding different sort of species down there, all the species down there are like transparent. They have no eyes because they lived in the dark and they only have ears. And it's like, whoa, that's kind of trippy shit. And then all of a sudden, you know, this is being monitored and watched by a father and a daughter in two different places. And in the book, it takes place in England and London, around area, and then goes up to Scotland. Well, here we're setting it in New York, Manhattan, and then going up to Canada where it's cooler eventually. But all of a sudden, they're – pulling one of these scientists up out of this cave, and it's just nothing but a red pulp. And you go, what the hell is this? And out come these things that are just fluttering, flying, and they're bats that are the size of small cats that, you know, they're about this big. And they have no eyes, and anything that makes a sound, they attack. And they reproduce really fast, and there's a shitload of these things, and they are unstoppable. Literally, you can take down an F-14. You can take out an airliner. They are unstoppable, and the world is becoming literally apocalyptic. But it's all told through the story of how this family, this girl who's 17, another 17-year-old girl, which I love, is kind of the lead. She's deaf. And her deafness in her handicap and their ability to sign and communicate gives the family an edge in living in this world of silence, where if you make noise, you got to be really careful, you're going to die.
I do love a good monster bat.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it also sounds like you're going full rated R.
Oh,
wish,
yeah.
Wish upon, you know, you got to go a little more teen oriented.
No.
PG-13.
We're going deep. We're going deep on this one. It's frightening. It's an excellent script.
Now, I'm going to back up to Wish Upon for a bit. I'm sure that it was difficult to approach because the villain in the movie is not an actual person, but an inanimate object.
Good point.
That literally it just kind of sits there, plays music occasionally.
Right.
How did you approach creating it to look sinister, be sinister, and kind of act sinister? Because you do it does feel very sinister when it's on screen.
Well, you know, it's got to the theory always was that it's got to be enticing, yet very creepy. And, you know, it's got to be interesting and mysterious and all the things that when you think ancient Chinese music box, it fills, you know, that void perfectly.
Right.
Then it's about the sound and the you know how the what the little tune is and how God bless you.
Thank you.
how the little chime plays and you know and when can you distort it and you know when can you not and you know when she hears it it's got to be the real tune because again you have to always approach every single one of these things realistic first, real first. And then, you know, when you get into the more psychological aspects of the film or whatever, then you, and when you weave that into the score, then you can start distorting that tune. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, I actually, first I Googled creepy Chinese wish box. And I found this thing that was actually beautiful. And an ancient Chinese wish box, or old Chinese music box, I mean. And it gave me an inspiration for it. And then I even found this tune. That's what it was. I Googled ancient Chinese music box or in Chinese music boxes. And that's where I found the box. But then I Googled creepy music box, Chinese music box tune. And I found this synthetic thing that was created in synthetic music, you know, online, and it was almost could have used it for the movie. It was that, I mean, people heard it and were like, ooh. But, it was really hard to like, it was a challenge to create that thing. And, you know, seven wishes, it's an octagon, so seven facets with the locking mechanism, making the locking mechanism so it's random, so nobody can figure out. You don't know how to open it. So the only way it opens is by itself. Think about all that. And then literally we came up with it, and I have in my house the top of it. There's a like a it's like Dante's Inferno where the demon, Yao Gui, they call it, the Chinese demon is in the center, and he's kind of chest out, and you see these souls from hell like trying to pull themselves up out of hell. And this cool guy in the art department, just happened to be a Chinese guy, he hand-carved and shaped this whole thing in clay. And then we 3D printed it.
Yeah.
And we made, you know, multiples of them. I mean, it's crazy. Bob Zimbicki, our production designer, you know, he was very instrumental in it as well. And together we just kind of massaged it. It came out pretty cool. I mean, I'm pretty proud of it.
My final question on Wishpana is, does Ryan Phillippe really play the saxophone?
You know, he did.
Tell me he's got that skill, but tell me he's multifaceted.
You know what? He doesn't, but guess what? I have that saxophone too at my house. It's an old, we bought it off of eBay, and it was like an older Italian sax. It's really cool. No, he's just an avid pro. Our composer gave him the tunes way before in prep. We did that. But he was just really good at faking it. That was a good question.
Well, I watched it. I was like, props to him if he really knows how to play. Because I dropped that shit when I was like in the sixth grade. I couldn't play
saxophone. It's a challenging instrument. Not a lot of people master it.
Yeah, that's one I would like to learn, actually. Yeah. I thought about teaching my granddaughter, and then if she learns, then I could learn with her, and it might force me.
Also, mad props for casting Barb from Stranger Things in there.
Hey,
wonderful to see her. I had to double check that.
I know. And Sherilyn Fenn. Yeah,
who's still gorgeous.
That's what
gorgeous.
I was going to ask.
Yeah. Still gorgeous.
She is.
Tell us everything about Sherilyn Fenn. For me and Elric, Twin Peaks fans.
Oh, my God. Sherilyn, you know, she was a pro. She's really interesting lady. She, you know, for her to go through what she did with the garbage disposal scene. She was a trooper, but there were moments where it was really freaking her out, I have to say.
So she was actually attached to it. I assume that they'd brought in like doubles and things like that.
No, we did it all with her. We put in a stunt part where she was like really twitching, and that was a double, that part. Mm-hmm. But it was actually the wig and the prosthetic was on her, and we yanked it. Had someone underneath there pulling on from underneath the garbage disposal. We did that in a practical kitchen. We just built our own island into the middle of it, and it was very tight. But we did it, and she started to freak out a little bit. And then Paul Jones, our makeup effects guru, who's amazing, did the life form of her. For when we came back and Joe or Claire sees her,
Talking about the woman who survived boxing Helena.
That's right.
You think you can scare a woman who had to like show up to work to that set every day? It's like, geez.
That's a good point.
I mean, she's got no arms or legs in that movie. It's like, I don't even know what the hell that was.
She's a trippy lady. Yeah. She's really a neat lady. And you know, she brought a lot of sweetness to that scene with her, and Claire. When, we set up the garbage disposal and she's giving her the green drink and all. Right. That's a pretty sweet scene between the two of them. And then, I don't know, and yet she's a little tweaky. She's a little like twin peaky tweaky, when you see her come back, it's like, oh, fuck. That's kind of creepy, I think. But
nice. It's fun. And that's out this Friday?
That's out this Friday.
Same day as this episode.
Yes.
Look at that. Synchronicity.
We planned it that way. Figure, Elric.
Now, when do you go up to Toronto for Silence? The Silence?
Within 3 weeks.
Right on.
For 4 months.
Well, good luck.
Thanks for sharing such great history. It's really great.
My pleasure, you guys.
Yeah, it's magic.
And we will be back next week.
Yep.
With another episode.
We're back on our regular schedule, everybody.
That's right.
Talk to you soon.